At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All we want for Christmas is some desperately needed help. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 24th of December. Glad to have you with us. Over in Europe today, they finally reached a deal on Brexit. On this side of the Atlantic, no such luck. After President Trump refused to sign the coronavirus relief bill, Congress spent months negotiating. He's now in Florida, leaving Washington and America in limbo over what happens next. Many of the programs keeping millions of families afloat are set to expire in just a few days. That stripped-down relief bill we thought was going to pass left out aid for state and local governments. States are now fighting each other over which should be able to collect income taxes for the hundreds of thousands of remote workers who used to commute across state lines. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Before the pandemic, Dave Miranowski commuted every day between his New Jersey home into work at an architecture firm in Manhattan.
I ride my folding bike to the ferry, and then I take the ferry across.
He also has to file taxes in both places. New York is one of seven states which tax workers based on where their physical office is located. New Jersey normally refunds the more than $1 billion paid by residents like Miranowski, who have to pay taxes to New York. But this year is different.
I think it was March 15th when my office closed.
So New Jersey and about a dozen states are bringing the legal question to the Supreme Court to try to stop states from taxing workers who never step foot in the office.
And this becomes a serious problem if remote work becomes a long-term phenomenon, as it probably will.
Jared Walsack with the Tax Foundation says while states have had agreements to avoid double taxing workers, that could change.
If your home state decides that you truly are both living and working in their state, then they may still tax you.
Especially as states struggle to make up a drop in other tax revenues due to the pandemic, says Louise Shaner with the Brookings Institution.
Clearly, there's some pain on things like parking tolls and gas taxes.
And drops in tourism and sales taxes. All that's pushed state revenues down an average of 5%. So every last tax dollar counts. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
It was a quiet day on Wall Street, but we'll have those details a bit later when we do the numbers. With Washington still at odds over the next coronavirus relief package, nonprofit organizations, including churches and other faith-based organizations, have stepped in to fill the gaps in the social safety net by providing food, clothing, and other services for people in need. But like all businesses and organizations in 2020, churches have had to adapt to survive this pandemic. Reverend Chris Butler is lead pastor at the Chicago Embassy Church Network. Pastor Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly.
One thing maybe a lot of folks don't know is that churches in many communities provide a lot of social services, food pantries, educational resources, spaces for support groups to meet. How have those services that you and other churches provide changed during the pandemic?
So they've changed in two ways. One, they have become much more needed. You know, food access, information sharing about, you know, just general health. We've done a lot of COVID screening at the church, not just with members, but community members as well. And then the second change that I would point out is just that how we can deliver those types of services has changed. Certainly, it was much more of a challenge with folks who, you know, weren't living so much of their lives on computers, even getting computers into some folks' homes, teaching folks how to get on those computers, helping folks establish social media accounts and learn how to do Zoom. There were several cases in which we did put a device in a household to help them access not only worship, but in 2020, that's access to work, that's access to family. So we did see that as important. And so we did do that a number of times.
Many churches also provide social connections. I mean, my dad was a deacon in our church growing up, and I remember very clearly going around after church on Sunday, visiting, you know, the sort of sick and shut-in, as we talked about, sort of older people who maybe were confined to their homes or people who were ill. How do you provide those sort of social support services in the church in a pandemic?
That has maybe been one of the biggest challenges. I mean, we've moved our grow groups, which is what we call, what most people probably know as small groups, online, Zooms and Google Meets. But there's certain elements, I think, of person-to-person contact that there's no substitute. As the pastor, right, like not being allowed to go into the hospital to pray has been a big challenge. I don't know that there's a huge fix for it. We've augmented things with technology. I don't think that we can replace it.
Mm-hmm. So we know that church membership in the United States has been declining for decades. What do you think that this pandemic will mean for churches and the services they provide in the long term?
Yeah, so I think that this pandemic has actually presented the church with a great opportunity. The decline that we've seen over decades in church membership is real. And the church has a real critical moment to face where we have to ask ourselves, are we going to, once we're beyond the virus, are we going to go back to doing everything exactly the way that we used to do it? Or are we going to take this as an opportunity to change some things? You know, every church in America now, you know, virtually has an online ministry. That was not the case a year ago. That kind of rapid mm-hmm. expansion of online ministry. I remember on Easter, the church broke the internet, right? We got an email the day after Easter from Facebook saying, you know, we're sorry if your stream went down because there were too many churches streaming Easter service.
Wow.
We incorporated them so that we can adjust to COVID-19, but some of it has yielded a lot of impact. I know I have people who tune into the stream every week who never have and probably never will walk into the door of this building where I'm sitting. And so there's an opportunity to rethink church, and I hope we take it.
Reverend Chris Butler is lead pastor at Chicago Embassy Church Network. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Like I mentioned earlier, the UK and the European Union reached a deal today on just what their relationship is going to be like after the UK fully leaves the bloc next week. The agreement allows for tariff-free trade in goods and contains provisions on everything from fishing to aviation to civil nuclear cooperation. Nuclear power is an important source of energy all over the world, and like many nations, the UK has struggled to get its nuclear policy right. Big nuclear power stations are notoriously expensive and prone to long construction delays, so one idea is to produce lots of small ones instead. Here's the BBC's Justin Rollette.
The nuclear industry doesn't have a great reputation. It's plagued with stories of plant construction taking a decade or more, with cost overruns in the billions of dollars. Now, a business group led by British engineering giant Rolls-Royce thinks it may have a plan that could avoid all that by making nuclear power stations smaller.
You build it in a factory, you commoditise the process, and that same factory can then build a fleet of these units across the UK.
It's a production line. It's like the Model T Ford.
Yeah, it's commoditised. It's a factory-built nuclear power plant.
Tom Sampson is the chief executive of the UK Small Modular Reactor Consortium. It's announced plans to build up to 16 mini nuclear plants in the UK over the next 5 years. It is being presented as part of the British government's plan for an environmentally led green economic recovery.
Well, this technology is not untried. This is a traditional pressurised water reactor. It's the most commonly deployed nuclear technology in the world today. And we see a huge opportunity for this technology to be adopted globally.
Sounds alluring, doesn't it? But they don't come cheap. We are talking around $2.5 billion for each unit. There's also the question of demand, because Britain isn't the only country looking to mass produce mini reactors, as the clean energy consultant Michael Liebreich explained to me.
Well, so the last time of checking, there were about 50 different groups around the world promising small modular reactors. And it was all of the usual suspects. So far, there's only one relatively new design that is out there, and that's actually a Russian floating nuclear plant on board a ship called the Admiral Lomonosov. But mostly, these small modular reactors are actually still working their way through the regulatory system.
The truth is, creating any kind of global market for these reactors is going to be an uphill struggle, because nuclear power in general has become so unpopular. Doug Parr is chief scientist at Greenpeace UK.
As we have seen not that long ago, even advanced, well-regulated countries can still have quite serious nuclear accidents, as happened in Japan at Fukushima. So the worries have shifted. Climate change has become much more of an issue, but fundamentally we're still opposed.
Greenpeace is not the only sceptic. Nuclear physicist M.V. Ramana is a professor at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
The nuclear industry started off with small reactors, and there was a reason why those designs grew to become larger and larger, and that's because the only way nuclear power could compete economically with other sources of power was to take advantage of what are called economies of scale. And small reactors are reversing that process. And the last thing to remember is that even if you're talking about 10 years from now, the competition will be renewables, which are going to be far cheaper than they are today. So I don't think that Rolls-Royce, if and when it manufactures this, will find a market that's interested in buying large numbers of these.
So opinion is split, but one thing there is wide agreement on is that however successful these small nuclear plants are, nuclear will only ever be part of the answer. In London, I'm the BBC's Justin Rollette for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We used to have a beautiful, huge dining room table for breakfast where everybody sat around.
The before times. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 70 points, 0.2%, to close at 30,199. The NASDAQ gained 33 points, 0.2%, to end at 12,804. The S&P 500 was up 13 points, 0.3%, to finish at 3703. We mentioned the post-Brexit deal earlier. Automaker BMW revved up 1.7%. Industrial conglomerate Siemens lifted 2.3%. And about that pandemic relief, or lack thereof, some 11.3 million households are behind on rent or won't be able to pay next month, according to the Census Bureau. Moody's Analytics puts the backlog in unpaid rent nationally at an estimated $70 billion. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. When it comes to online shopping, this year has been extremely busy for retailers. So busy, in fact, that there are shortages of drivers and warehouse space, plus backlogs at the U.S. Postal Service have made it harder for companies to get products to customers on time, like those holiday mugs I ordered for my nieces and nephews that were supposed to be here a week ago. Marketplace's Justin Ho spoke to a couple of retailers to see how they're handling the situation.
Ever since the pandemic started, Tom Butcher has been refocusing his Seattle-based synthesizer store, Patchworks, on e-commerce. He's advertising more, building up the store's website.
We're spending a lot more money on supplies, you know, boxes and tape, and it's amazing how much tape we go through, honestly.
Lately, the company's been fielding a lot more questions from customers. Where's my package? And it's been harder to tell them when their order will arrive.
The logistics systems are really overtaxed.
Dale Rogers is a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. He says in addition to a glut of Christmas packages, shippers are also trying to deliver COVID vaccine, which means retailers are competing for whatever warehouse and trucking capacity is left.
And if you're a small guy, you don't necessarily get priority.
Back in May, Sarah Piepenberg's trucking carrier told her it could no longer work with her Minneapolis olive oil and vinegar store, Vinaigrette. The replacement she found was a lot more expensive, so...
We have to charge $20 for shipping, which we just raised our prices, by the way.
Customers have complained, which is hardly ideal at the most crucial time of year for the store. Piepenberg says she's been too scared to estimate how sales have been going.
It's a third of our entire revenue for the year. It's made in 6 weeks.
Piepenberg has offered some customers free shipping by delivering their packages herself. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Hopefully, we'll get some movement on this relief package soon. Check out my colleagues on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest. Opening a restaurant is a risky financial proposition, even in the best of times. Throw in a global pandemic that has people staying at home, especially during the normally busy holiday season, and it can seem like the literal worst of times right now. This next story is about a couple who took a look at that daunting challenge and said, "All right, let's do this. Let's open a restaurant." From LA, David Weinberg has the story.
All right, we are fired on a cauliflower and potato chorizo taco.
It's a Wednesday night in Highland Park, a neighborhood in northeast Los Angeles. And chef Danielle Duran-Zeka is in the kitchen putting the final touches on an order before handing it off to a server.
Aldo, we're going to table 25.
She's been working for years to become a head chef. Here at Nativo, she designed a menu that combines the flavors of Mexico and Italy.
I am a Mexican. My husband is Italian, so I love to combine the best of both worlds.
Out back, the parking lot has been transformed into a dining space with wood walls and multiple levels. Mexican blankets are draped over bales of hay for seating, and a young couple with a baby is taking selfies underneath a spinning disco ball hanging from a tree as the bar manager, Grace Perez, strolls by holding a bundle of burning sage.
I feel like we all need a cleansing sometimes.
The vibe is festive, but there's an undercurrent of sadness and uncertainty among the staff. Because tonight is the last night of dining before a countywide ban on outdoor dining brings a sudden end to what had been an opening week of full reservations.
We remember day one, it was just overwhelming because we didn't know how busy it was going to be.
This is Gabriel Paredes. He and his wife are the owners of Nativo.
You know, my wife and I, we sold everything to make this come true, right? So, sorry.
No.
I feel silly even talking or getting emotional about it, but yeah.
It means a lot to Paredes that he was able to open his own restaurant here in the neighborhood where he grew up. His parents came to L.A. from Mexico before he was born.
My father actually used to sell boots on the city, right? So it was him, my brother and I, you know, just kind of trying to make ends meet. I've had friends, you know, get killed on this same street that we're on. And it's just awesome to come back and be able to create jobs and contribute, right?
It was 40 jobs before the outdoor dining ban. And before Perez and his wife became restaurateurs, they started a financial planning company that they ran for 14 years.
Our market was low to middle income families that have been overlooked by the financial industry. So we really focused on educating them on finances. Just couldn't do it, though. It wasn't my passion. The only other thing I knew how to do or I really understood was beer, right? I didn't go to college, so I said to myself, let's open up a bar of some sort.
Paredes knows the risk of opening a restaurant and that the stakes are much higher for people like himself who don't have the economic safety net of generational wealth.
People in my kind of age group, we are not only taking care of our kids, right, but we're also taking care of our parents.
Paredes says he pays his parents' mortgage on a condo. He sold his childhood home to open Nativo, so a lot is riding on his restaurant.
If you don't hit your dream, you're done, and you won't be able to support the people that are relying on you, such as kids.
For now, Nativo is offering takeout only, which allows him to at least keep the kitchen staff employed until outdoor dining can resume. In Los Angeles, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
The end of the year usually means big business for hotels, especially in Hawaii. Before the pandemic, as many as 30,000 visitors arrived every day. That dropped to fewer than 500 per day back in March. Hawaii has eased some of the restrictions the state imposed back then, and we asked one small business owner to share his story of the last year.
My name is Thomas Fairbanks, and my wife and I own the old Wailuku Inn on Maui. It's a small 10-room bed and breakfast inn, and we've been operating it for 24 years. So I've been in the hotel business for almost 50 years, and with including the last few years here that I've been retired from the hotel operations per se, but operating our own. So it's kind of my life, and my wife has made it her life too. We met in the hotels business ourselves 47 years ago. Maui is the largest, or the most successful, I should say, destination in Hawaii. And so we have this huge infrastructure to support first-class experience, a Hawaiian experience, yeah. Now I think we may be getting several hundred people arriving a day, maybe up to as many as 800, whereas in February we were receiving about 30,000 people a day. So it's a huge difference. Right now, business is very slow because of the COVID going on. So we are probably averaging 10% occupancy. Prior to the COVID was probably 80. Well, we've definitely changed our operations as far as the way we clean rooms and stuff. We don't clean rooms every day anymore now because, you know, it's not safe for our staff. So we just do it on departure, unless they're long stays. We used to have a beautiful, huge dining room table for breakfast where everybody sat around as a group. And we had to, of course, adjust that. Now we have small little tables, and we put a lot of tables outside, little tables that people can enjoy the garden and have breakfast. But of course, we haven't needed it yet. We always have to feel hopeful, otherwise it's not worth getting up and staying, keeping the doors open. You know, a lot of our business comes from the West Coast, and looks like the Northwest is shutting down, and California, a lot of it too, I think. So we'll see. I think a lot of people want to come. It's generally a time when people like to travel, you know, and people with money, so they don't mind, you know, staying in hotels and things. So we'll see. We hope so.
That was Tom Fairbanks in Maui. Tell us about your economy online at marketplace.org/myeconomy. And this final note on the way out. If Justin's story about shipping delays has you worried about, say, mail-in ballots for the Georgia runoff, there was news today in the Washington Post that USPS has reached a deal with civil rights groups to speed up ballot processing for the Senate runoff on January 5th. The Postal Service is promising to let ballots bypass clogged processing facilities, and those that are taking too long will be treated like express mail to make sure they arrive in time to be counted. And now for your Thursday moment of economic context, the real-life cost of this stalemate here in Washington. Sure, it could cause a partial government shutdown, but failure to pass new pandemic relief also means that within a week, about 14 million people could lose jobless benefits, and tens of millions of people behind on their rent could face eviction. Okay, we gotta go. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.